Case number 13-5147 et al. State of Alaska, Appellant, Southeast Alaska Power Agency, Amicus Curiae for Appellant, Alaska Electric Light and Power et al. Versus United States Department of Agriculture et al. Mr. Borgeson for the Appellant, Mr. Smeltzer for the Appellee, and Mr. Lawrence for the Intervenors.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Dario Borgeson. I represent the State of Alaska, and I'm arguing on behalf of all the plaintiffs in these consolidated appeals. The roadless rule was a monumental change to the management of the country's national forests. It took 58 million acres, which formerly were available for timber harvest and other uses, and set them aside for conservation. The rule has outsized impact in Alaska because, unlike the lower 48, where there are many roads in the national forests, over 90% of both the Chugach and Tongass national forests are in inventoried roadless areas. Most of the plaintiffs' claims in this case are unique to Alaska and have not been ruled on before by any court, so not only is it legally correct to allow the plaintiffs' claims to go forward, it's important that a regulatory action of this magnitude in Alaska not escape judicial review. Section 24-01A's limitations period can and should be told in this case. It's presumed that equitable tolling is allowed unless Congress makes a clear statement otherwise.
Could you address the what you call a reopener doctrine first? Because the other argument takes us into dicier issues.
Of course. The lawsuit filed in 2011 is timely because a new cause of action accrued when the California District Court reinstated the roadless rule in 2006. The defendants and appellees argue that there's no final agency action, but there is final agency action here. There's no dispute that the agency reopened the roadless rule, solicited new proposals on how to manage the nation's roadless areas, and obviously has adhered to the roadless rule. It's a final rule that determines the rights and the interests of the public, and in practical effect, what the agency did is no different than if it had formally readopted the roadless rule in 2006.
Isn't your core argument there was a substantial period prior to the decision, the 2006 decision of the California court, in which actions, court and agency, meant that any claim would be treated as moot by a court, so that filings in that period would be a complete nullity.
That is correct. From the period of 2003 to 2011, any filings challenging claims specific to the Tongass would have been unable to move forward because the roadless rule simply did not apply to the Tongass until the Anchorage District Court in 2011 struck down the Tongass exemption, and the same would be true until 2006. Due to the state petitions rule having invalidated the roadless rule for a period of time.
There is no rule in effect at all from 2005 to 2006, right?
That's correct. The roadless rule was not in effect at all from 2005 to 2006.
May 2005 to September 2006.
Correct. Okay. And I think when the court is considering this reopening claim, you should remember that if the California District Court's decision had come out just 4 or 5 months later in 2006, no claims against the roadless rule would ever have been timely, and the roadless rule would have escaped all challenges because all previous challenges had been mooted by the Forest Service's decision to vacate the roadless rule and replace it with the state petitions rule. I do want to return again to, in case the court does not decide that that filing was timely, to why equitable tolling should be permitted.
Well, just could we pursue this reopening for a moment? The government makes at least two arguments. One is that part of your reopening argument is waived. And then the constructive reopening argument is forfeited because it wasn't mentioned until the reply brief.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I can address those two. The waiver argument is wrong. The theory, the specific argument is a little bit different than was made before the district mm-hmm. court, but the parties still made a reopening argument before the district court. And in the cases cited for the government's proposition that's been waived, it was an entire claim that wasn't made before the district court in those cases. And thus, the appeals court said, no, this claim, this entire claim is waived. Here we made the claim that the Rollis rules limitations period was reopened in 2006. And we've changed the argument a little bit, but it's the same claim, and it shouldn't be waived. As for the forfeiture, again, the constructive reopening is just a reopening. It's the same argument again. There are slightly different cases, again, that have described when the reopening is a constructive reopening, but a constructive reopening is still a reopening. It's no different, and it does address the issues raised in the appellee's brief.
How much good does the reopening do? Right. In other words, the label's been applied to a couple of discrete circumstances. One, a case where the agency looks at the disputed provisions themselves, thinks about it, and readopts them. Seems to be the hardcore of it. Then there's the situation where the agency changes not the disputed provision itself, but the surroundings, making it changing essentially the stakes. Though that's those seem to be reopening cases. Mm-hmm. Here's a case where the distinctive feature is that partly because of judicial action, partly because of the agency's action, you have the rule simply becoming unchallengeable because lacking any effect. So all claims against it are moot. And then you have the somewhat unusual circumstances, I guess it's unusual, of the court reversing all that by recreating it in its original form, although in two steps, as you point out. You can call it reopening, you can call it anything, but it seems to me quite distinct. And you have good reasons, it seems to me, to argue that essentially the right only accrued to you in the California court decision in 2006, period, full stop, without any talk of reopening.
Well, right, and a reopening is in a way a shorthand for saying a new cause of action accrued. That's reopening triggers the accrual of a new cause of action. And that is our position, that a new cause of action accrues.
So viewed, it hangs together. I guess I'm not, and that's a way of characterizing the reopening doctrine.
Yes. And so that's our position, again, is that a new cause of action accrued in 2006, and then again in 2011 with the striking down of the Tongass exemption by the Anchorage District Court.
So let me just go back. The government made those procedural arguments, and then it also made sort of a broader jurisprudential argument that we don't want to mix up reopening, which is focused on agency action, and the type of thing that happened here. And here it's a court reinstating a rule, and the agency doing nothing thereafter. So there was no, as it were, post-court ruling agency action to attack.
There's no formal adoption of the roadless rule subsequent to the court's reinstatement of it. It's clear that the agency has renewed its adherence to the roadless rule, which is what the reopening doctrine requires.
Pursuing, the agency hasn't done anything. The agency's position was, we want the state petitions rule. That got reversed, and the court put back the roadless rule, and the agency said,
we like the roadless rule now. So.
Well, it didn't even say that. I mean, it literally said nothing, as far as I can tell. And the argument you're making about a new cause of action accruing, it's the same cause of action you had back in 2001, where you entered into this settlement agreement. And the question is whether, thinking about this in a broader sense, what you're really saying is that because of your 2401A argument, that the statute, any limitations period, should be equitably told for the reasons you've been discussing with Judge Williams.
That's the way the government characterizes our argument. Our position is that irrespective of whether 2401A can be told, a new cause of action accrued in 2006. And again, going back to the constructor reopener cases, the combination of judicial...
So you get to, I just need to be clear on this, you get to challenge the rule twice.
That's
even
correct.
Though, even though you settled the first time.
That is correct. Because the agency, again, has renewed its adherence to the rule. It reopened. It sought comment. It sought different proposals on how to manage the nation's national forest. It thought about it. It did initially go with the state petitions rule, but the ultimate culmination of its decision-making process was to stick with the roadless rule.
So if the agency, after the California District Court had issued some notice saying we've decided not to move forward with an effort to correct the procedural flaws that the district court found when we promulgated the state petitions rule, we're going to stick with the roadless rule. That, the agency didn't do anything specific to that effect, but you're saying in effect it did.
Yes, that was our position. And I think you can also distinguish, you know, the reopening argument from the tolling argument. The reopening argument applies to a pretty narrow realm of cases, only this select area of agency rulemaking cases, where the tolling argument applies to all claims that could be brought under 24A, which is a much broader class of claims. So reopening argument is much narrower in that respect than the equitable tolling argument.
So the government says, well, you can always challenge the rule in as applied context.
That's not entirely true in this case, especially with the plaintiff's Alaska-specific claims. The first one is ANILCA, National Land Interest, ANILCA, where basically our position is that it prohibits withdrawals of public land in Alaska without authorization by Congress. In the withdrawal happened with the roadless rule, by withdrawing all that acreage for conservation purposes. The future Forest Service actions, amendment to forest plans or timber sales, they're not going to have that same effect, and we'll never be able to challenge ANILCA because the roadless rule was what violated ANILCA. As for the Tongass Timber Reform Act claim, in theory, you could make a future as-applied challenge, but the problem is that the roadless rule exerts a downward pressure on demand for Tongass timber. Buyers of timber will look elsewhere to meet their needs. In the future, it may well be possible to meet market demand for Tongass timber, but that's because it's going to be artificially depressed by the roadless rule. So every year that the roadless rule is longer in place, the chances of success of a TTRA claim diminish because of the roadless rule. So it's not correct to say that the state can make these claims in the future as applied challenge. Mm-hmm.
Well, the reopening precedent is relevant on that too, because the court's applying that concept. I've never said, well, forget it.
That's correct. If there are no further questions on the reopening point, I will move. Well, I want to address also the Tongass Timber Reform Act arguments that the defendant interveners have raised. Under the TTRA, the Forest Service, subject to the other laws that govern the Forest Service, must seek to meet market demand for Tongass timber. And if that means anything, it means that the Forest Service can't voluntarily impose on itself a rule that makes it impossible from the outset to meet market demand for timber. And the intervener's position is that, well, because it's subject to these other rules, the obligation to seek to meet market demand is simply, it simply means that timber must be managed as a co-equal use with all other potential uses of the forest. But if that's what the TTRA means, and it's a meaningless statute because there's already a statute that provides that, that's a multiple use sustained yield act, which provides that the Forest Service has discretion to manage all the potential uses of the national forest as it sees fit. And so if the duty to seek to meet market demand for Tongass timber means only that after all the other uses have been balanced and met, then the Forest Service can try unsuccessfully to meet demand for timber, it basically is a meaningless statute. But the court should reject that argument for what the TTRA means. If there are no further questions at this time, I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Counsel for Eppley.
May it please the Court, John Smeltzer for the Department of Agriculture. Your Honors, the District Court's judgment should be affirmed for three reasons. First, Alaska's cause of action to challenge the roadless rule first accrued within the meeting of the statute of limitations in January 2001, more than 10 years before Alaska filed this claim in the present case. Second, under the law of this circuit and Supreme Court precedent, the six-year statute of limitations under Section 2401A is a limitation on this court's jurisdiction, and this court is not free to toll the statute on equitable grounds. And third, even if equitable tolling were available under Section 2401, Alaska has not alleged facts that would support tolling.
So if an agency adopted a rule and then repealed it, and then adopted a new rule a year later, 5 years later, whenever, that is actually identical to the previously repealed rule, what happens in terms of statute of limitations?
The statute would run from the final, the last of those three final agency actions that Your Honor described, which
is the adoption of the new rule.
Adoption of the new rule.
So why isn't that this case?
Because we don't have final agency action in this case.
I know. What's different about, I mean, there was a repeal, correct?
There was a replacement rule, that's correct. The state petitions rule.
And it repealed the roadless rule, right?
Effective.
And so there was nothing to challenge in that period in 2005 and 2006.
We can see that.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess the question, and I agree it's not covered exactly by the cases, but by it seems like the District Court of California decision, effect, at least for these purposes, is the same in effect as the agency readopting a previously repealed rule. And I'm trying to see why that wouldn't make sense of the statute in kind of a narrow way without getting into the other issues. And, you know, there is something about your position that seems unfair, and I realize statute of limitations are often unfair, so that may not be a mark against you, but why isn't this approach of this is just like the agency readopting a previously repealed rule the easy, fair way to get out of this case?
Well, the agency didn't do that. Mm-hmm. There was no new final agency action, and the claim that was brought in this case is a claim that's challenging the 2001 decision. I mean, the complaint names the 2001 adoption of the roadless rule and asks for review of the 2001 record. That is when the claim first accrued. And for purposes
of... I agree that a claim accrued then. It's really, I mean, begging the question.
Right. Well, we submit the proper way to look at what happened is there was an obstacle right? There is a intervening rulemaking and a rule in place for a period of time that was an obstacle to bringing suit. But when that obstacle was removed by the California District Court's decision, that did not create a new claim. It just removed an obstacle to the original suit. And that's exactly how the plaintiffs treated it. They came back and they pled in their complaint a challenge to the 2001 agency rulemaking.
Counsel, you're relying on a very literal interpretation of the statute, where first accrues is something that happens once and only once. It can't ever happen again. But the whole Reopener doctrine, and here it seems to me that the use by Alaska of the Reopener doctrine is useful, discards that view. It takes the view that notwithstanding the language first accrues, a cause of action against a rule can accrue because of various circumstances which radically change the context and make the situation different from what it was before, and it and therefore amounts to the same as the starting of a new cause of action.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree in the sense that first accrues is plain language and is talking about when that claim first accrued. What happened here, and with respect to the reopener doctrine, the bedrock of all of the reopener cases is a new agency action. Now, sometimes
new
when the
agency action, but there is not a change in the action challenged.
And if there's not, then the reopener doctrine doesn't apply.
No, that's not true. No, well, the reopener doctrine applies when the agency reconsiders the matter and comes to the exact same conclusion that it did originally.
Right, but the change is that there is a new administrative record, there's a new reconsideration of the issues, and a new considered decision on the issues. Here, they're going back to the 2001 administrative record. They want to review the original 2001 decision on that record,
I mean,
which is not a new
consideration. If you look at the reopener cases, I don't think you'll find that the what's said in the second look at the issue is important in deciding that the reopener doctrine applies. But I don't think you'll find in those cases any deep reliance on what was said in that second process.
Sometimes not, Your Honor. I think you're referring to the constructive reopening cases. I mean, what the case...
In this case, I never focused on constructive versus not constructive.
Right.
But,
right. What the case... All of the cases have a new agency action, and then the question before the court is, when the agency takes this new final agency action, did the agency, when you look at the context of the entire record, give serious substantive reconsideration to the issue? What's lacking here...
That's only with respect to the running of the statute, not in terms of the merits.
That goes to the question of whether there's a new claim that accrues at the time of that new action with respect to what was reiterated. You know, did you substantively reconsider what was reiterated? There's no new action, right?
Let me give you an alternative to Judge Kavanaugh's hypothetical. Suppose the agency says, it adopts a rule. 3 months later, it says, we cancel that rule. But if nothing happens to persuade us not to persevere in it, it will take effect automatically again in a year. And if nothing happens, it takes effect. When did the action first accrue there?
It's an unusual hypothetical, Your Honor, but I would think the cause...
Yeah, but this is an unusual case. I don't think we're calling from using unusual hypotheticals.
But again, there would be the agency deliberately saying, in a year, if nothing happens, we want this new policy, there's something
right.
else to come back. This is a situation...
Nothing thereafter.
Right. But again, the agency has made a determination on a record, made a final agency action that the court can review. What the...
You aren't saying there's any difficulty in reviewing the action here, right?
Well, it sounds like when we hear the State's Council describe what they're trying to do here is they're trying to challenge our decision to acquiesce, right, in 2006. They're saying we made a new decision in 2006. Well, it would be a remarkable thing if this court were to determine that agency's decision not to seek search.
I don't think that's necessary to their claim. They're challenging the 2001 decision.
Well, that decision first accrued, the challenge to that first accrued in 2001.
But then it disappeared, and then it reappeared.
And again, if you're looking at fairness considerations, we think the proper construct is equitable tolling, which we believe doesn't apply here. But ordinarily, in administrative...
In the reopener cases, the court has never tried to file them under equitable tolling, has it?
That's correct, Your Honor. This is not like any other reopener case this court has ever decided. And what I'm suggesting to the court is to, for example, as we said in our brief, suppose you've got a rule that's on the books for 20 years. Challenged or not challenged, it's been there for 20 years. New rule is promulgated by the agency, immediately challenged, immediately set aside, old rule reinstated. If somehow the reinstatement of an old rule is enough to be a reopener, then all of a sudden this 20-year regulation that's been, you know, not subject to challenge for 14 years is reopened. Now, that just doesn't make sense. This is not an argument that fits within the language of...
Why does that not make sense in that case? I mean, well, if it's an illegal rule and it comes back into effect...
Well, again, we're talking about a 20-year rule, and if it's illegal, presumably it would have come up somewhere during the time. Ordinarily, in administrative law situations, when you have a regulation, you know, you've got facial challenges and you have as-applied challenges. At some point, it's going to be applied to someone, and it's going to affect their rights. Mm-hmm. At that point, we concede that there is a challenge if it's in violation of substantive law. When it's applied to them, that it can be challenged.
What about the idea that this, your theory, could really dramatically shorten the statute of limitations if these facts were to replicate themselves? And in this case, it did, in effect, shorten the statute of limitations, because if they had filed in 2005 after it was repealed, I assume you would have said...
You would have said it was moot at that point.
Yeah. Yeah.
It didn't really shorten
normally you get 6 years, and I think
had the 6 years, right? They had the 6 years. Just if they had brought it in this intervening period when there was another rule in place, it couldn't have been brought during that time. But
I'm saying, suppose the California District Court decision had come after the 6 years had expired.
Right.
Just hypothesize that. You shorten the statute of limitations period, and I think the law is pretty clear that you're just as entitled to file on the last day of the statute of limitations period as the first day, and this your theory would, in effect, penalize those people who chose, for whatever reason, to wait to the latter half side of the statute of limitations period.
There would be a hardship imposed, mm-hmm. potentially. But again, it's not all challenges would be removed, and again, that's not this case. The court's decisions recognize that, you know, sometimes in an individual case there will be a hardship under the statute of limitations, but it is a jurisdictional limitation on this court's ability to hear a case, and you know that's somehow where the chips fall.
Maybe in we this should case, wait to find out what the Supreme Court does in those two Ninth Circuit cases as to 2501B.
2401B, Your Honor.
2401B.
Yes. There is a cert petition with respect to 2401B, which is related to 2401A, not this precisely the same issue, because it applies to a different set of claims, and the pedigree in 2401B is shorter than 2401A.
You say, and not get any answer that really helps us on the 2401A question.
I think whatever the Supreme Court says might provide helpful precedent after that case is decided, in the sense if the Supreme Court were to hold that 2401B is jurisdictional, we would have an additional argument, right? Because in addition to everything we've said, the Supreme Court would have added one more. It wouldn't change the arguments we're making in this court, because 2401A is, for all intents and purposes, wed with 2501. They began as the same statute in the Tucker Act, the Little Tucker Act.
On the new right of action theory, if we were to rule against you, it seems like a one-off case. There are not other cases like this that you're aware of, I gather, or that we're aware of, or that we can find cases on that have been like this historically. So I guess as far as we know. So what's the harm in terms of, besides this particular case, of adopting what seems like a sensible interpretation, although I'm loading the dice here, but sensible interpretation of the statute to allow this claim to proceed?
I think the harm
would be...
What's
the broader harm?
The broader harm would be, is what I said before, the statutes of limitations are supposed to be rules of repose. If you adopt...
I'm just saying, in this, is this particular fact pattern or something... linked with it, likely to arise very often. It seems not, given looking backwards.
Right. But the rule that Alaska asked this court to apply isn't wed to this fact pattern, because the rule they want you to apply is the rule that when a rule is judicially reinstated and the agency does nothing, takes no action, and just complies
with
the court order.
But how often does that happen?
That's a reopen.
How often are statutes
or regulations set aside? More often than the United States would care.
Reinstated by a court after the agency has repealed it.
Well, no. What often? Because if the court sets aside a new regulation, the standard rule is the old one comes into effect. That will happen almost every time an agency sets aside a regulation.
I think
you fall back.
Well,
on the
fact pattern here is the agency itself repealed it.
The agency created a new regulation that they at that point preferred as a matter of policy. The court set it aside. You just fall back on the old regulation. That is a common pattern that will recur all the time. And there will be lots of cases where that happens, and the regulation in the original regulation in effect will be well past any 6-year statute of limitation for procedural claims. And there would be no way to distinguish this if, you know, judicial reinstatement is a reopener.
You said that statute of limitations is a statute of repose. Who was reposing on the roadless rule in the period between the state petitions and the reimposition by the California court?
I'm sorry, are you asking it with respect to a particular time period, or are you asking about now?
Yes, because I mean, you say it's protects repose. Okay.
Right.
Who is reposing on the validity of the roadless rule?
I think fundamentally, anytime the Forest Service, Department of Agriculture, tries to do something in this area, they get sued. And they get sued on this direction, they get sued on the other direction, and then the rules become very complicated as they enact a regulation and they get sued on that one. If they've passed one that's beyond the statute of limitation and there can be no procedural challenge, there's at least that bedrock that they're not going to be sued again on that one and that they can try to move forward in the regulatory framework. If they are sued every time, you know, something's reinstated, then you're always going back and down to, you know, one step up, two steps back as you're trying to redefend a regulation that, you know, was passed in the Clinton administration in 2001 when we're, you know, four presidents later. And it's very difficult for the Forest Service to not be able to focus on the future with some sort of bedrock beneath them as to how they can move forward.
But there haven't been cases. So even though you posit that this scenario could arise, as you said, all the time, it hasn't arisen all the time for whatever reason.
I think the principal reason is when a rule is reinstated, it's then applied. And if somebody objects to the application of the rule, they have a challenge that's not time-barred. I see my time's up, Your Honor, unless there are further questions.
Wait, repeat that last. I got to follow that again.
In the ordinary circumstance,
yeah.
If a regulation is repealed, and therefore, by operation of law or by the order of the court, the prior rule is
the
reinstated.
The old rule is reinstated, yeah.
The agency is then under a legal duty to comply with the old rule, and the agency will proceed to manage the forest or to do whatever it is the agency's duty
as is applied challenges you're talking about.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah, okay.
So the argument here is that doesn't work because the challenge they're seeking is the original,
right.
You know.
As to procedural challenges, this court has said that you would lose a procedural challenge. But the court's precedent is very clear that you wouldn't lose a substantive challenge in an as-applied context. So, yes, not the entire panoply of challenges would remain, but still some.
The other thing, though, just to go to the as-applied challenge, is in this scenario, historically, there's a litigious, there are litigious parties that want to challenge agency action, yet this, even before the as-applied, on its face, pre-enforcement, and yet this scenario hasn't happened historically, as far as you're aware. Right?
An as-applied challenge with respect to the roadless rule?
No, I'm just talking about the general scenario of the agency replacing a rule with a new rule, court rejects the new rule, so the old rule comes back in. We haven't had lots of cases where someone's then tried to get into court challenging the old rule anew, in essence.
I'm speculating, Your Honor, that the cases, when they're challenged, when the old rule is reapplied,
yeah,
the challenge is raised, there's no statute of limitations issue, so it doesn't come before this court.
But no one's tried to challenge. I mean, we just haven't seen a lot of cases. I'm just trying to posit whether or to figure out. You're saying this will happen all the time and create significant consequences.
What I'm confident will happen frequently is legal challenges to new regulations and courts setting those aside and new rules being reinstated. I'm confident that will happen in circumstances where the old regulation is already beyond.
Right. Why hasn't that happened so far is the question, because for the last 25, 50 years.
I'm not prepared to say it hasn't happened, Your Honor.
Well, I'm thinking of a case before this court where it was an old rule, all right, and the statute of limitations had run. But then some of the petitioners claimed that it had only recently been applied to them. So their claims, we held, were right.
Correct.
So it's a little different, but that's what you're arguing.
That's essentially what we're saying, yes. If the rule is applied specific to injure prospective plaintiffs in a final agency action where there is an APA challenge, there is no time bar.
So right. Under your scenario, at what point would Alaska, in an as-applied, what's the as-applied as to Alaska that would enable it to bring this challenge?
Could potentially be a forest management decision on a site-specific project where the agency says no to a particular request because of the roadless rule.
And the argument would be the only authority the agency has to act is this original setting aside.
I'm sorry. I mean, if there were a site-specific action where the agency relied on the roadless rule to say we can't do that, we can't do what you asked us to do, and then the plaintiff said, but the statute says we can, and there's a conflict between the statute and the reg, they're going to be able to bring that claim. They're going to be able to say, look, there's a conflict. They won't be able to bring a facial challenge to the rule, but they will be able to bring it in that site-specific context. And if the statute gives them a right to do something that the reg would take away, you know, the statute trumps.
So you heard counsel when I asked him about the as applied. You heard his response. You're just disagreeing with him? He is incorrect?
He did not address all of Alaska's claims. He addressed the claim under ANILCA, and I believe he was talking about a procedural claim. If it were a procedural claim, then
he's lost it.
He's correct. He's lost it. If there's a claim that a specific action that the agency takes potentially in reliance on the roadless rule also violates ANILCA or also violates a statute where there's a substantive duty to do something else.
No, I understand, but as I understood his response, and just let me be clear about this, it's that the state in an as-applied context would not be able to, I'll put it this way just for brevity, a facial challenge to the original decision under however you pronounce it, ANILCA.
Yes. I mean, there wouldn't be a facial challenge.
He is correct about that, isn't he?
Yes. I mean, that's basic in line with this court's precedent.
So when the agency makes some change in timber management, you're saying the ANILCA claim could only come up to the extent that the management claim was based on the roadless rule that was based on the...
He was talking about ANILCA, and I apologize for not being familiar with the ANILCA claim. We didn't brief the ANILCA claims. We didn't brief the merits at all. This was about the statute of limitations. what I can say to the court is mm-hmm. that if there is a claim that there's a duty on the mm-hmm. USDA in managing the forest that they violated in a site-specific decision, a statutory duty that conflicts with what they've said in the roadless rule, and they could bring a claim and they could make that argument. They could say, and if they're correct,
yeah.
if they're correct that application of the roadless rule in that circumstance, you may not build a road here in this roadless area because of the roadless rule. If that would violate a substantive duty in a statute, they have that claim.
All right, but as I understood counsel's basic point was that what Alaska wants to attack is I'll put it this way, the 58 million acres.
That's all of America, right?
Well, no, that's what his opening statement was.
No, he did, but he was talking about all of America. That's not just the roadless areas in Alaska. The roadless rule covers 58 million acres
all
in
right.
California. And
they're Nevada. Concerned about the land in Alaska. No,
they're concerned about the Tongass and the Chugach.
Chugach.
One of their substantive forest. Claims is under the Tongass Timber Reform Act.
Right.
And they make a substantive claim. They say under the Tongass Act
right.
that if you were to deny a permit for a road or do something or to cut timber, that it would be facially violative of the Tongass Act. I mean, if there were there presumably would be an as-applied challenge, and counsel didn't argue otherwise.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything further?
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask the court to affirm.
All right. Thank you. All right. Counsel for interveners?
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Nathaniel Barnes for the interveners. My co-counsel here is at the table with me is Thomas Waldo. We urge the court to do what it did in Kramer v. Gates and Felter v. Kempthorne, to set aside for another case thorny and far-reaching questions about 2401A, and to settle the dispute between the parties here by finding that as a matter of law, the requested relief cannot be granted. The 2401A question, in our view, is best addressed in when it's presented to you by parties who depend on it for the resolution of their dispute. Here, Alaska would not benefit from such a ruling, and the federal government doesn't need it. And the reason is that at all events, Alaska doesn't qualify for equitable tolling, but for one facially insupportable claim under the Tongass Timber Reform Act.
Well, in terms of avoiding the difficult issue raised by Sand, there are two ways. It's the way you propose, and the other alternative is to use some version of the reopener doctrine, right?
That is correct, Your Honor. The rule at issue here, the litigation here, casts lingering uncertainty over a landmark federal rule adopted 13 and a half years ago that has survived the coming and going of 9 other lawsuits. If you decide on 2401A grounds, the likelihood is that uncertainty will be perpetuated, that such a ruling will lead the parties, one or another of them, to seek further review, and that subsequently there may well be a remand to the district court followed by another appeal back to this court. Repose is overdue, and it's in your power to achieve. We ask that you achieve it by ruling that at all events, the plaintiffs here have long since exceeded the statute of limitations but for their Tongass Timber Reform Act claim, which on its face must be denied as a matter of law.
That would be new law by this court, right?
That issue has never been directly addressed in this case, but we think it's readily disposed of by bedrock law about adherence to the face of the statute. It's clear
but
that
we would have to make new law on that point. I mean, we've never said anything about that, and Alaska disagrees with your view.
The meaning of the statute, the Tongass Timber Reform Act, is a matter of first impression in this court, which would be decided as a matter of law, mm-hmm. whether it's decided by the district court or directly now or later on appeal again from the district court when it came back here by this court, if not this panel. Mm-hmm. We think it's readily disposed of. To find for the plaintiffs on their TTRA claim, you would have to rewrite TTRA in two important ways that are not permissible. First, you'd have to take an exhortation to seek to provide timber to meet market demand and turn it into an absolute substantive bar on the agency taking any action that prevented it from actually meeting market demand. And second, you'd have to read out of the statute the proviso that providing market demand is subject to a whole battery of other statutes, including the requirements of the National Forest Management Act, which in turn requires USDA to have an economically and environmentally sound road system and to set timber harvests in light of the full panoply of multiple uses, precisely what it did in the roadless rule. Those two changes to the statute can't be made consistent with this court's law and the Supreme Court's law about starting with the plain language of the statute and adhering to it unless there's some reason to think that Congress had a different intent. Mm-hmm. If there are no further questions about the TTRA, I'd like to return quickly to the ANILCA argument that Council of the State of Alaska made. The ANILCA claim is a claim that...
This hasn't been briefed by anybody, is that right?
It has not been briefed.
Right.
You inquired about whether or not...
I understand.
...he had an opportunity to raise
yes.
it. He has ample opportunity, and I'd be happy to explain the multiple opportunities he will have to raise that substantive claim, either in challenging decisions or in a petition to the Secretary.
All right.
Okay. Let me turn quickly to the reopener doctrine. The core of the reopener doctrine is that an agency's renewed adherence to an old rule is substantively reviewable under the APA. That's public citizen. It requires a promulgation by the agency that involves formal agency action.
You say it requires all the cases that involved a repromulgation. There's not a case of this circuit that says, well, if it were done by a court, we, of course, would not allow that. Right?
Because it's the renewed adherence of the agency that is subject to litigation, the new challenge. Not its old decision, but the new decision on the new record it's made. And because there was no substantive...
You make it sound as if the only thing reviewable in that case would be the reasoning given in the second agency decision. That's not the case.
To the extent that there's a substantive violation in the original rulemaking that's imported into a subsequent agency decision, that is reviewable. But your cases do not allow a procedural challenge to the original rulemaking after the running of the statute of limitations. Reopening allows a challenge to a new agency decision under the Administrative Procedure Act, even if the agency has simply decided to stick with the status quo. That's the core of the reopening doctrine. There must be a subsequent agency proceeding. There must be a subsequent agency action, and it's reviewable under the APA precisely as if the agency had decided to change the status quo. That is the core of the reopening doctrine.
Why isn't this a stronger case even, since the rule was not in effect and could not have been challenged for a period of time?
Because in 2006, there was no agency action.
Mm-hmm.
The agency decided not... Actually, in 2006, the agent, despite what the state says, the state did appeal the California District Court decision. Mm-hmm. So it didn't acquiesce in that. Mm-hmm. They would have you believe, however, that if there had been acquiescence, that would somehow have constituted agency action. But you can't make a decision whether or not to abide by a court decision or to fight it on appeal subject to review under the APA. That would be a dramatic expansion of the Administrative Procedure Act. There's no precedent for that and no reason to do that here.
Well, there's no precedent either way on the fact pattern we have here, correct?
I think because all of your reopener cases require a subsequent agency action, there's plenty of precedent.
But there's no case where this has come up, as Judge Williams says, and we have said, well, we're not going to allow it if it's a court resurrecting a defunct rule.
Judge Kavanaugh, there are the so-called constructive reopening cases. Mm-hmm. Those cases stand for the proposition that when in a given agency proceeding, an issue raised in a prior proceeding has been given a different legal context by an intervening judicial opinion, that issue is reopened in the subsequent proceeding whether the agency wants to or not. It doesn't allow an agency in a subsequent proceeding to ignore an intervening judicial decision that has changed the legal landscape with respect to a prior decision. That's constructive reopening. But there's a subsequent agency proceeding, and here there was not. There was simply an appeal, and after it was appeal, if there was an agency action, I suppose it was the decision not to petition for certiorari. But you can't make that an agency action reviewable under the Administrative Procedure Act, and that is what you're being asked to do here. And for that, there is no precedent. If I may, my time is up. If I have 30 more seconds, I want to address very briefly the allegations in the amicus brief here about a parade of horribles that are going to attend the electrical generation industry in Southeast Alaska. In that brief, which is based on a declaration that was attached to an uncontested motion to intervene in the district court, doesn't mention any projects, any specific projects that are, in fact, that have been barred by the roadless rule. The projects it does mention were specifically excluded from any impact of the roadless rule by the district court's order in the Tonks exemption case. Yet those projects and several other electrical generating projects were specifically exempted. That the judge in that case, in the Tongass exemption case, found that similar allegations about interference of the roadless rule with communications and utility connections among communities were without any basis in the evidence in the administrative record in that case. If there were such an interference with an important public project in Southeast Alaska, the utilities would be able to raise that in multiple ways. They could raise it with USDA by petitioning the secretary to give them an exemption from the roadless rule, as the secretary has done for the state of Colorado and the state of Idaho in response not to petitions under this state petition rule that's been invalidated, but simply ordinary garden variety APA petition. They would also have the ability to raise an as-applied challenge. So they're not out of luck if their argument, if in fact someday some meritorious public project arises, which is blocked by the roadless rule. If there are no further questions, we urge you to save 2401A for a day when it's presented to you by parties who depend on its resolution for the resolution of their conflict, and instead to reaffirm the court below, the judgment of the court below, on the alternative grounds that the plaintiffs don't qualify for tolling here and that their TDRA claim can't be granted consistent with the face of the statute.
Thank you
very much.
All right. Counsel for appellant?
Can you be very specific about what it is that makes an as-applied challenge, in your view, inadequate?
Well, let me start with the Tongass Timber Reform Act claim. In isolation, to challenge specific Forest Service decisions on a particular timber sale, it's very difficult to say that any specific decision violates the mandate to seek to meet market demand, because there could always be reasons in any particular instance to say, well, this is what market demand is, and we'd like to meet it, but this area needs to be reserved for conservation purposes or for watershed purposes or recreational purposes. And so it's very difficult in specific decisions to say, aha, the Forest Service violated its duty to seek to meet timber demand. What is clear a violation of its duty to seek timber demand, to seek to meet timber demand, is placing all this acreage off limits to timber harvest, which in its complaint the state alleged, which has to be taken as true, that makes it impossible to meet market demand for Tongass timber. That's what violates the Tongass Timber Reform Act, and that's not necessarily going to come up in individual site-specific decisions on particular timber sales. I mentioned also that the problem with the downward pressure on demand that the roadless rule exerts, the longer the roadless rule is in place, the less demand there's going to be for Tongass timber. Mills will close, buyers will look elsewhere, and in the future, the demand for Tongass timber is going to be very low. So the roadless rule will have done its job in that regard, and it will be very impossible to challenge what it's doing now. And again, with the Anilka claim, it is the problem with our position is that the Forest Service effectuated a withdrawal of public lands in Alaska, which is prohibited under Anilka, without congressional action. And again, any specific decision that may be made in the future won't effectuate a withdrawal. If we're challenging that decision, we're not going to be able to say, aha, that's a withdrawal. We're going to be stuck with challenging that decision on the merits, when in reality it's the Robles rule that violated ANILCA. I also want to address briefly the worry of the government that if the court rules that this is a reopening, that it's going to open all kinds of all sorts of rules to challenge that had previously been settled. First, it is not the only remedy or the automatic remedy when a regulation is struck down to reinstate the previous regulation. So that limits the class of cases where this might come up. And again, I think the court maybe could rule as a judicial gloss that if the limitations period on the prior predecessor statute had run, there's no opportunity to challenge that, and that would balance the interests of judicial review against the interests of finality that the government is worried about. If there are no further questions, I would respectfully request the court to reverse the decision of the district court and remand for further proceedings.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take the case under advisement.